Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Lachlan Summers. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Mark Anderson, who has just written the book From Boaz to Black Power. Mark Anderson is an associate professor of cultural anthropology at UC Santa Cruz, where he is also the chair of the anthropology department. He received his PhD from University of Texas at Austin and was a Harper postdoctoral fellow at the University of Chicago. Alongside work and edited volumes, his work has been published in History and Anthropology, African and Black Diaspora, and the Journal of Latin American and Caribbean Anthropology, among several others. His first book, Black and Indigenous, Garifuna Activism and Consumer Culture in Honduras, was published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2009. Here, Anderson examined the politics of race and culture among the Garifuna, highlighting the mutual entanglements between indigeneity and blackness and between diasporic affiliations and nativist attachments in order to analyze the unstable and ambivalent modes of identification through which people represent themselves and negotiate oppression. Mark has kindly joined me today to discuss From Boaz to Black Power, Racism, Liberalism, and American Anthropology, published last year by Stanford University Press. Mark, thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you, Lachlan. I'm flattered to be here.
In the interest of full disclosure, I'm a graduate student at UC Santa Cruz, where I've TA'd for Mark and taken classes under him, and I quickly became his favorite student of all time. Right, Mark?
Of course.
Okay, so I got that on the record, but we're here to discuss this book. But before we get started, I want to know, how are you at the moment and what's the state of the pandemic where you're currently based?
Oh, boy. I'm fine. I have a job and a job that allows me to work from home. So I feel very fortunate. We're in, in Santa Cruz, where the pandemic has not been as pervasive as some places. But California is seeing an increase in cases. So we're just hanging in there, doing the best we can.
Okay. Well, I hope it gets better quickly, but I'm not entirely convinced it will. But anyway, I want to hear about your academic history, like where you went to school, the colleagues you studied with, and the colleagues that you studied under.
Okay. Well, I was a undergraduate major at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where I was actually, or I, that's where I did my undergraduate degree. And it was a philosophy major, actually. But the philosophy major didn't have many requirements, so it allowed me to explore other things than the liberal arts, humanities, social sciences, so anthropology, Latin American studies. And then as a senior undergraduate student, before then, I became interested in Central America and had the opportunity to go to first Costa Rica and then Honduras. So decided I wanted to pursue anthropology and didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to do work in Central America. I ended up going to the University of Texas at Austin, where my first year advisor was Edmund T. Gordon, otherwise known as Ted Gordon, who had spent a decade in Nicaragua working on Ted's African-American. He was working with Afro-Nicaraguans or Creoles on the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua and within the context of the Sandinista Revolutionary Project in the 1980s. And so through his influence, I became interested in Afro-Central American peoples and the politics of race and culture in Central America. And that's what led me eventually to this work on Garífuna in Honduras. That is the very abbreviated version of the intellectual trajectory.
So how did this book emerge from this earlier work? So you did this ethnographic study with the Garífuna and now a history of anthropology. How did these two works relate?
Yeah, so as you gave a nice gloss on the first book, Black and Indigenous, which was a book in which the project started as an exploration of Garífuna are a people of African and indigenous ancestry who were really, whose ethnogenesis is as a people emerged in the island of St. Vincent in the Caribbean after a series of conflicts with the British. The British deported them to Central America. They had been, Garífuna were, had long been of interest to anthropologists as a kind of unique cultural group. And there were lots of questions around, well, or culturally speaking, is their culture more indigenous? Is it more African origin? But there'd been very little work really looking at the relationship between Garífuna and the larger society in which they live. Did they experience racism? There wasn't that much on how did they identify themselves in racial terms. So that became the subject of my book. And as part of that work, I became interested in how anthropologists had been interested in Garífuna and how they'd written about them. And so I went down that rabbit hole to a degree. And then one Honduran historian named Dario Urraque, a fantastic Honduran historian, in an article had mentioned that there was a African-American anthropologist who was originally slated to study the Garífuna in the early 1940s. And if he had done that study, he would have been the first, or at least among the first, anthropologists to work intensively with Garífuna. But he was denied permission to enter Honduras because of racist Honduran immigration law. That story in and of itself was interesting and reflected obviously something about Honduras, but I became curious. His name was Hugh Smythe or Smith. I'm actually not sure how you pronounce his last name, S-M-Y-T-H-E. And I became interested in who was this person, what happened to them, and he turned out to have a really fascinating career. He was not able to study Garífuna in Honduras. He was a student of the famous anthropologist Melville Herskovitz, who was one of the kind of key anthropologists of the Afro-Americas, as well as Africa. And Smythe ended up having this fascinating career, kind of culminating in him being the U.S. ambassador to Syria in 1965. So I ended up delving into some of his archival papers, into the Herskovitz papers, and that kind of got me into just the history of anthropology, and especially in relationship to African Americans. So on the one hand, that pushed me in this direction, I think. On the other hand, I taught a course called Race and Anthropology at UCSC, which I've taught off and on for many years now. I can't remember even the first time I taught it. And in that course, I had the first section of the course was a course around the Boasian intervention around race and racism, its critique of scientific racism, but also later critiques in the 1970s, this article by William Willis, Skeletons in the Anthropological Closet, I had students read, and I had them debate the virtues and limitations, if you will, of the Boasian intervention. And when I originally assigned this material, I thought, oh, it's going to be really dull to the students, and they're just going to want to move on to the more contemporary engagements of anthropologists with race and racism. But it turns out they were actually quite fascinated, I think, by that history. And students will often, you know, approach historical works in a different kind of way than maybe professors do. So I kept kind of exploring some of that history, read more of the secondary material, and eventually ended up writing an article on Ruth Benedict's writings on race and racism. Benedict wrote a lot more about race than most people realize. She's famous for Patterns of Culture and Chrysanthemum of the Sword, but her other kind of major book was a book on race. And so the seeds of the kind of organization of this book were actually born out of that teaching, because it kind of begins, it's really covering the period from the Boasian intervention, and particularly I pick it up in the 1920s and culminates in the early 70s at this critical moment in multiple senses in anthropology. So that's a slightly long-winded answer to the question, but it kind of emerged out of, just some things. It wasn't a direct line of descent from one project to another, but there were these sort of tangential connections between both.
Right. You're working with the Garifuna, who identify both as Black and as Indigenous, and that kind of confounds the way that anthropologists talk about race and indigeneity. And so, you know, perhaps from there, you start to examine how anthropologists talk about race, which means in the U.S., you talk about Boas. Now, From Boas to Black Power is self-consciously about United States anthropology. And maybe just for folks that are not based in the U.S., what is the position of Boas in the imagination of the discipline of anthropology?
That's a really good question. So Boas is kind of colloquially known as the father of anthropology. You know, there were obviously anthropologists before him, but he looms large in a variety of different ways. I mean, on the one hand, he played a really important role in the restructuring of anthropology institutionally. His coming to prominence coincided with the full-on development of anthropology as an academic discipline. And many of his students went on to become key figures in emerging departments like at UC Berkeley and other places. He also figures really large in the anthropological imagination because of his anti-racism, his critique of scientific racism. His legacy is really important to a lot of anthropologists for that reason. He was also instrumental in developing the contemporary anthropological understanding of culture as it emerged in the 20th century. There are other ways in which Boas was hugely influential, but those are the key ones I'd identify.
Mm-hmm. I found it interesting reading it as an Australian, where Boas is not so large. He's kind of just like another anthropologist, like another early anthropologist, rather than one of these kind of like key early figures. And in preparation for this interview, I was revisiting an article that I'd read by Gillian Cowley-Shaw, who's a New Zealand anthropologist who researches among Indigenous Australians. And she was trying to, in the 90s, trying to talk about race in Australia. And kind of like you're mapping out in the United States, like race was not really an analytic that anthropologists were prepared to use. And so she's written an article that was eventually published, but it was denied publication in the United States. And then she wrote another article about the efforts to get that article published. And it's called, I think it's called Censoring Race. Mm-hmm. And she wrote about some of the comments, some of the reviewers' comments she'd read. And one of the comments was that she needed to go and read Boas again because anthropologists don't talk about race. Not to kind of give away too much about what you're talking about in your book, but I don't know, that really, really struck me as being something similar to what you're talking about.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I'd have a differing interpretation of Boas not talking about race. I mean, I'm guessing what the argument there would be is that Boas and his students, part of their critique of scientific racism and racist ideology was that part of it was that the really meaningful differences between human beings aren't to be found in their biology, that is, understanding race as a biological category of human difference, but in their cultural differences. And so some folks have interpreted the move from that set of arguments to mean that race is just something we really shouldn't talk about or use as an analytic, that it's not a meaningful way to really categorize human differences and therefore is not the proper category for social scientific analysis. There's a counter perspective, which is race, though a social construct, wasn't really a Boasian argument per se, but one that one can see developed out of the Boasian legacy, if you will. That doesn't mean doesn't have a social reality and doesn't, that the world doesn't continue to classify people along the racial lines that inherited from the colonial period, and that therefore race remains a very salient, not just topic, but analytical category that needs to be wrestled with. Anyway, I will now read that piece you're describing because it sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I'll send it through. One of the things you highlight early on is the way that Boas uses an immigrant analogy in terms of talking about race and also talking about the United States. Can you talk a little bit about what this analogy is and how it functioned in the anti-racist works of Boas?
Yeah, so sort of back up a little bit. One of the things I'm trying to do in the book is explore how Boas and Boasians, that's the short term for his students, they're really well known for the critique of scientific racism, for the critique of biological determinism. And one of the things that interests me in them is how did they think about what came to be called racism, but prejudice, discrimination, oppression, you know, based on racial differences, racialized forms of oppression. How did they understand that, and how did they imagine the transcendence or overcoming of, we'll just call, racial oppression? So one of the things that I try to explore in the book is when they're thinking about race and racial oppression in the United States, I think they're modeling their imagination of the development of a more liberalized society in which individuals would be treated as individuals, because it's a very liberal project that the Boasians have in this sense. Their implicit and occasionally explicit model for what that looks like is European immigrants who are understood to be assimilating into U.S. society. Just to go back to something you said before, though my earlier work was really focused a lot on transnationalism and diaspora and like how racial identities are created not just within local or national context, but also within transnational ones and through transnational encounters and interactions. And I have a real interest in how anthropology moves across borders and so forth. For this project, one of the things I realized was that Boasian anthropologists they thought a lot about U.S. culture, and they had a project of trying to intervene in U.S. society. It was a progressive liberal project. But when it came to really fully trying to confront racism in the United States, they're limited by this imagination of, or modeling of, the overcoming of racism, if you will, on the model of an assimilating European immigrant who's, of course, assimilating into whiteness, right? Which is being reconstructed and reconfigured throughout the 20th century. But that when, for those who are rendered beyond the boundary of whiteness, beyond the pale of whiteness, if you will, this is something, there's something of a paradox in this effort to imagine what, say, anti-blackness and what it means and what it would mean to have black liberation when the model is the assimilation of European immigrants.
Right. Yeah, this is one of the really striking things that you're talking about. Something that I definitely had no sense of in terms of Boas's anti-racism is these weird paradoxes that he gets himself into, in that he kind of constructs the idea of the U.S. in terms of a liberal future of human freedom, or of individual human freedom, and yet was very pessimistic about white people's capacity to think of people who aren't white as human. And relatedly, he's arguing constantly that race is not a biological reality. And yet he's saying that a very, you know, biological form of mixing was the only way to overcome the issue of race in the United States. Like, could you synthesize like some of these paradoxes and how Boas like grappled with them, or if he did?
Yeah, I mean, that is the subject of the chapter 2, I think it is, on Boas, is trying to sort of both identify and try to explore the train of thought that leads to these paradoxical positions that he ends up taking. You know, as a qualifier, I wouldn't say necessarily that Boas himself thought of or discussed race as a social construct per se.
Right.
But there is the way I frame it in the chapter is he has a article on U.S. African Americans in 1921 And he ends it. It's called The Problem of the American Negro. And the last line of the article is, thus it would seem that man being what he is, the Negro problem will not disappear in America until the Negro blood has been so much diluted that will no longer be recognized. Just as anti-Semitism will not disappear until the last vestige of the Jew as Jew has disappeared. Mm. There's a lot we could unpack in this sentence, but I would highlight one of the ways it's deeply problematic. Boaz was suggesting that the long-term solution to anti-Black racism was the lightening of the Black population in the U.S. through interracial sex. What he's referring to when he's talking about the dilution of blood is he's saying that it is a pessimistic rendering of the racial situation in the United States, where he sees, at least the way I interpret him, is he sees white racial consciousness as so kind of deeply pervasive in U.S. society and so deeply ingrained in individuals that until Blacks aren't recognizably different from whites phenotypically, it's hard for him to imagine a world in a U.S. world, I should say, in which whites treat Blacks as individuals, right? But this is paradoxical in the sense that he does definitely see racial consciousness as a product of social and cultural learning and environment and as a social issue, right? Yet he ultimately proposes, as you say, a kind of biological solution. So that's one paradox, right? Mm-hmm. What I'm interested in that chapter is sort of trying to figure out, how does he get here? How does he get in this, what seems to me a real bind, right? And part of it has to do with there's a liberal imagination of the overcoming of racism as people treat individuals as individuals. But if whites are enculturated not to do that, then at this point, there's the obvious kind of mechanism as well, education and socialization into liberal individualizing attitudes. But he seems pessimistic about that as a kind of realistic solution, in part because of his understanding of the force of culture. Right, of how important culture was in shaping individual thought and action. And he seems to largely reject the possibility of self-organizing among African Americans as a route towards political liberation that may just exacerbate the problem, I think, in his view. So the point of the chapter isn't so much to create a scandal. One could go down that road, I suppose, but to really figure out what's the sort of train of logic as a liberal thinker that leads him to this position. And I actually find his pessimism quite sort of interesting in a way, analytically, because it could have led him to a full confrontation with the whiteness of America, the way in which, because part of the problem with the question of having liberalized individual relationships between people is, what's the political unit in which people are operating? What's the nation state? But how is the nation state imagined, right? And Boaz understands fully well, American nationality is largely rendered as white, right? And so he and other Boasians recognize there's a difference between people who can be classified and categorized into whiteness and those that can't, that there's a political difference in their positionality. But their imagination of the overcoming of racism, because it's modeled on that assimilation of European immigrants, it can't deal with the color line, right? What Du Bois famously called the color line, that crucial radical difference between whiteness and non-whiteness, and particularly whiteness and anti-Blackness and anti-Indianness in the sense of indigeneity in the U.S. There's not an analytical frame that they have that seems to be able to sort of handle that, even though Boaz himself seems to be pointing towards this foundational problem of whiteness in the construction of American nationality and national belonging. But that has to be reckoned with, to my mind, in any full confrontation with racism.
Right. This is kind of a follow-up, but also kind of a sidebar. Mm-hmm. Just as I was reading this, I was wondering if you encountered kind of any indication that Boaz had been influenced by like the discourse of mestizaje when he's making these arguments. Just like my knowledge of mestizaje is localized to revolutionary Mexico, but my understanding is it drew on a longer Latin American tradition from independence movements like Simón Bolívar and José Martí, but it was also affected by some intellectuals of the Mexican Revolution like Manuel Gamio, who studied a doctorate under Boaz and then came back to Mexico and wrote Forjando Patria, which really foregrounded the mixing of races as a biological and political project of national unity. I had always thought that that kind of idea had come from this long Latin American tradition and from Boas, and that's how it kind of got to Mexico. But I'm wondering to what extent some of these Latin American ideas went to the United States, like through people maybe like Manuel Camilo. Did you see any indication of that kind of influence?
Yes. Yes. And it's a, it's a very pertinent question. And I think it's one of the other elements to his thought that I think is actually key to helping understand it. You know, you could also mention Gilberto Freire, famous Brazilian scholar who was known for his promotion of mestiçaje or the equivalent of it in Brazil. I think Boas, with, you know, part of the insight that what he refers to as racial consciousness is different across different social formations, I think, is informed by his understanding that in Latin American societies, racial consciousness is not non-existent, but it's not as, I don't know the right word, pervasive or acute or categorical as it is in the United States. That is, there's intermediate categories between white and Indio or white and Negro. There's a fairly, I think, common perception in the early 20th century that racial prejudice isn't as stark as it is in Latin America as in the United States. And so one of the ways in which I think Boas is trying to understand that is, well, there's a greater history of intermixture and greater kind of recognition of intermixture in Latin American societies. And so the consciousness of race as a kind of the link between, say, blackness and a discrete social category isn't the same in Latin America as it is in the United States. So this is definitely, I think, informing his thought. There is a Latin Americanist, if you will, influence to his thinking. And he's drawing on that fairly consistently in the 20s and 30s. And he sees a difference in the U.S. And so he is a proponent of interracial marriage, both, I think, on the grounds of there's no biological reason to oppose it. Like the biologically speaking, it's nonsense to imagine so-called racial mixing as being a problem. But also he sees, I think, looking to Latin America, a mixed society as having the advantage of not having social categories be directly tied to racial categories. Now, in giving this account of perceptions of Latin America Boas was drawing on, I don't want to endorse the notion that race is less problematic in Latin America than in the U.S. There's been a lot of work, including my own, that contests that position.
Right. So in the middle of the book, you note the increasing presence of Marxian theory in anthropology through early figures like Ruth Benedict, but later through like Marvin Harris and Eric Wolf and so on. And Marvin Harris, like your discussion of Marvin Harris was particularly interesting to me because I only knew his like truly bizarre work on like diets, ecologies, and religion. But his early work is about like race in Brazil and Latin America, and is actually like more sophisticated than I expected it would have been. But over time, he starts to ignore the nuances. You note that he starts to ignore the nuances of his earlier work on race and takes this gradual turn into these kind of more full-blown, like, materialist explanations of things. Like, how do you position this gradual turn toward materialist theories rather than, like, more nuanced examinations of race?
Yeah, well, he's a fascinating figure. Yeah, it's sort of a nice segue, actually, from the last set of issues, because I guess just to give a little bit of the backdrop for the audience, Harris becomes interested in race partially because he's part of a project. This is from Columbia University, where Boas was also located. In large measure, this book is about Colombian anthropologists. Sort of, that wasn't any intent, but it ended up being that way. And there was a project on that was already underway in Brazil, led by Charles Wagley. But UNESCO in the post-war era identified Brazil as a study that should be, as a country that should be studied because it was viewed as a country with relatively mild racial conflict, a country characterized by higher degrees of racial harmony. I would be putting these in quotes if I could do the scare quotes visually. Harris studies race relations in a Brazilian town. And what I found fascinating about this early work was, to me, he develops a pretty nuanced ethnographic account, both of the nuances of a Brazilian racial classification system, which is quite different from the United States in a lot of ways, but also of discrimination and prejudice and the relationship between race and class, where the meaning of, in local terms, of class categories is inflected with racial meanings. And he's quite clear that can't be reduced race in this and kind of anti-blackness and the high valuation of whiteness inflect understandings of class, but can't just be reduced to them. Later, he develops a more comparative look of race in the Americas, driven by a political economic kind of Marxian approach. And I find this a really interesting moment and opportunity in anthropology. An anthropologist kind of moving on in a way from a Boasian legacy, really trying to think about racism in relationship to political economic structures. Yet it ends up losing some of the subtlety of the insights of the earlier work and largely really foregrounding class as the real issue in a lot of ways. It does make some really, I think, important and interesting comparisons between racial classification systems in the U.S. and Brazil, but ends up also, I think, minimizing racism in Brazil. Partially, I think, because there's imagination of segregation based on concrete and discrete categorical differentiation between people as the sort of maximal form of racial oppression, I think I call it. And kind of downplaying the ways that racial oppression can occur in situations of relative fluidity in racial classification, that is, you still have anti-blackness, you still have white supremacy taken in the sense of a high value placed on whiteness in social life and economic life, and that there's a kind of missed opportunity in this work in the 50s and 60s for a really nuanced comparative cross-cultural study of racism in the Americas. That it's fascinating to read because there's a potential there that to me seems really exciting, but it gets short-circuited and in some ways by pretty liberal understandings of what racial oppression really is.
So on the topic of kind of like missed opportunities, yeah. Like you note that that Harris seems like he's going one way and then kind of pulls it back and goes a different way and so kind of misses an opportunity to really kind of critically engage with anthropology as a discipline. A big part of this book is the sixth chapter where you're noting the critical perspectives of, you know, Black anthropologists and anthropologists of color, you know, principally calling attention to the racial politics of the discipline in a bid to decolonize it. But then you note that, you know, Faye Harrison releases Decolonizing Anthropology in 91. Just last year, there's a book that's published, a co-authored monograph called Decolonizing Ethnography. Like you're pointing out that these opportunities for a real, like, rigorous critique of the discipline, they kind of get a little bit sidelined. Can you talk about what's happening in the long 60s here and why these perspectives were maybe neglected?
Yeah. Yes, and thanks for this brings us to the sort of whole arc of the book, which is sort of, aside from the conclusion, the real endpoint of the book is this period in the late 60s and 70s where there is, some people call it the crisis in anthropology, some people call it a kind of radical turn, but there's a broader moment in the context of World War II, kind of formal political decolonization, the civil rights movement, and then Black Power movement in the United States, and then, of course, Red Power and Chicano Power, and you know, things are happening in Mexico at this time. And even more broadly, in academia, there are a lot of critical issues and questions being raised about what is the academy, you know, in anthropology, what is anthropology for, who's it serving, what does it do for the people who anthropologists study? And within that context, there's also the emergence of still not large numbers, but larger numbers of anthropologists of color who, in the moment of the rise of Black studies and efforts to reimagine the university, organize and have interventions in the AAA and are engaged in a kind of collective movement to rethink anthropology. And so this chapter is about, basically I focus on three figures who wrote kind of critical and perspective essays about anthropology. One is William Willis, Skeletons in the Anthropological Closet, Diane Lewis, Anthropology and Colonialism, and both those authors are scholars are African American, and Charles Valentine, who's white, who writes a book called Black Studies in Anthropology, exploring the relationship between anthropology and the field of Black studies, which had really taken off as an academic field in the late 60s and early 70s. And they engage in a whole host of, sort of representatives. I see them as kind of representatives of a larger set of struggles going on at the time in which anthropology is being politicized in a very self-conscious way, in which the traditional kind of parameters of what anthropologists could be studying and who should be studying what is being questioned. The term native anthropology gets coined by Delmas Jones at this time. At least that's my sense of the coinage. There's a development of a critique of the culture concept or the ways the culture concept can be used to essentialize in ways that are analogous to forms of racial essentialism. That critique is really first voiced, I think, or not first voiced, but developed in this period to a degree that I think is kind of often not understood by later generations of anthropologists. I could go on and on, right? There's a whole host of interventions that are made. And then part of it is also a re-examination of the history of anthropology. And Willis develops critical insights into the Boasian intervention. And part of it's being also inspired by critiques of liberalism, and particularly white liberalism, that are really pervasive within Black power movements and within Black studies. So the whole role of the academy in the production of racist social formations is being questioned. And so for me, this is the kind of first decolonizing moment in anthropology. And it's very interesting that we're now, basically 50 years on from that moment. And there's a continual need for a call to decolonize anthropology, in successive generations, right? And I think like Faye Harrison is very much aware of and cites the work of folks were doing in the early 1970s, writes about it in the introduction. But some of these figures haven't got the recognition I think they deserve. In the conclusion, I highlight that. It is, I think, interesting question to reflect on. Why is there this sort of continual need for a call for the decolonization of anthropology? What does that tell us about anthropology? There are battles in anthropology initiated in that era that continue to persist.
All right. So thinking about the book as a whole, like your book is critiquing like Boas and Boasians kind of like within their time rather than outside of their context. So you're not, this is why you've got this kind of focus on like missed opportunities and so on. So you're not like letting the fact that these folks were, maybe more progressive than their contemporaries, like and newer them from critique. But you're also not just juxtaposing Boasian anti-racism with contemporary anti-racism. Can you talk about how you approached writing history here?
Yeah, and I would like to hope that's what I'm doing. I think there may be some readers who disagree with that assessment, Lachman. But yeah, I think it's, any time you write, all history at some level is presentist, right? You're motivated by contemporary concerns. So, it would be, I think, sort of foolish to deny that. But I do try to, the question of then how do you contextualize the Boasian intervention, which I think it's really important to emphasize. I do describe it as anti-racist. I think I don't want to minimize its importance in the earlier chapters. I mean, one way to make a juxtaposition is, I talk about this 1924 immigration law that's being promoted by a set of scholars, some might say quasi-scholars in some cases, but using the science of eugenics and drawing on, scientific paradigms and language to advocate for highly racialized forms of immigration restriction. And Boasians were opposed to that, right? And publicly engaged in a project of contesting that, right? At the same time, a large drift of the book is trying to pinpoint contradictions, paradoxes, limitations of the Boasian intervention that I think the critique I develop is enabled in part by whiteness literature that's developed later, or other critical race theory that's developed later, and so forth. I don't think that exempts me from trying to develop those insights on earlier work. And at the same time, I don't think it's sufficient to just say, well, Boasians are writing in a time of entrenched, overt white supremacist discourse and language, and that's the context we have to understand them. And that is the context we have to understand them. But there's also intellectual context that we can compare them to, right? And other thinkers who are contemporary, right? There are Marxist forms of critiques of racism being developed at the time. There are, the route I take is at different moments, I compare elements of what a Boasian thought to certain African-American intellectuals, whether it's St. Clair Drake or Oliver Cox, who comments on Ruth Benedict's work, or Elaine Locke and his relationship with Melville Herskovitz, which could be a much longer subject. But to point out ways in which African-American intellectuals were, there are other anti-racist kinds of forms of thought that in different ways I see as highlighting different possibilities of thought than the Boasians themselves necessarily pursued. So that's one of the ways in which I try to, I'm not satisfied with just a position that's comparing them to the proponents of scientific racism, for example. But that doesn't, we can hold these two things together, I think, right? Recognize the importance of the critique of scientific racism and highlight paradoxes and limitations, and the ways in which they are really key to the making of a liberal anti-racist imagination, which I think needs to be put under critical scrutiny, right? Because that's part of the legacy that's been inherited, both within anthropology, but more broadly within the U.S. The whole colorblind discourse is sort of obvious place to go, right? I think it's more and more recognized that's utterly inadequate to confronting, you know, racism, whether we're talking about, you know, in the 20th century or today.
So some people might read this book and say, what about the close relationship between the Harlem Renaissance and Columbia anthropology? Or what about the fact William Willis, you know, really held Franz Boas in high esteem? Like, how do you respond to this?
True. Yes. Right. I mean, and I try to point some of those connections and relationships out. Mm. There were many Black intellectuals who saw the Boasians as allies and drew on particularly their critiques of scientific racism and their sort of authority as scientific experts on race to in certain ways. At the same time, it doesn't mean that Du Bois or Boas, to take two examples, thought about race and racism in the same ways or produce the same intellectual imagination. Again, these two things could be sort of true at the same time. Black intellectuals certainly could appreciate the Boasian tradition, but it doesn't mean that was it, right? that there weren't developing more kind of radical insights about, say, structural racism, which is like a hallmark of a lot of Black intellectual thought in the 20th century, whether it's called that or not. Yeah, Willis was deeply appreciative of Boas, and he also critiqued Boas. Right. And I think he, even by his own account, the more he learned about Boas, the more he appreciated him. But I don't think that negates some of the critical insights he had in his essays in Skeleton around the Boasian intervention.
Right. And throughout the book, yeah, you're noting a bunch of, you know, different anti-racisms that the discipline of anthropology might have been able to take. And yet these various ideas were neglected for various reasons. But I just want to kind of like maybe visit a couple of these scholars. And like, you can just say like St. Clair Drake, Oliver Cox, Elaine Locke, William Willis, like folks that are not necessarily like part of the canon in anthropology, maybe just for folks that are really interested in kind of pursuing, you know, what this anti-racism is and what it might look like now. Like, could you maybe just mention a couple of works by some of these scholars?
Yeah. So, and I think of the ones you mentioned, the actual Drake is an anthropologist. Locke was not, though he engaged anthropology a lot. Oliver Cox was a sociologist, but anthropologists should be reading people besides anthropologists too, for that matter. So all these folks would, you know, are folks that, you know, but maybe I just stick with Drake because, and just as a sort of side note, Drake was the advisor of Ted Gordon, my advisor. So in some way, he's my grand advisor, if you will, who is really fascinating figure. He's gotten some more attention recently, particularly for his work around the African diaspora, because he was really, he did his dissertation at the University of Chicago on the UK and a Black community in the UK. He worked in Ghana in the 60s. He did civil rights work. His study of Chicago Black metropolis with Horace Caton, I read a little bit about in the book, is recognized classic. He has later works. You know, one thing I'd point people towards, if you can find it, is my one regret from the book is he wrote an essay or delivered a series of lectures that he published in 1963 on African Americans and the American Dream at the 100th year anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. And it's a series of historical reflections on the United States and the struggle for African Americans to be part of the American Dream. He describes himself, I think, in the end as a kind of ambivalent liberal. And later in the 70s, Drake kind of identified himself as a Marxist. And I think he'd always had Marxist inclinations or Marxian thought influenced his approaches. But anyway, it's a really interesting set of reflections, both on the history of the United States and a kind of dialectical understanding of African-American struggles to participate in the American Dream. But when it gets to the end, and he's reflecting on integration. And this is at the moment of sort of at the cusp of the emergence of Black power in some ways. You can really see that ambivalence about, what does integration mean? What does that look like? Because part of, you know, insofar as the liberal imagination, integration involved assimilation, that creates all sorts of conundrums and paradoxes. Anyway, I'm kind of losing the thread here, but one of the things I've been interested in thinking about is comparing that work to work published in the late 70s by John Langston Gwaltney called Dry Long So. It's called A Self-Portrait of Black America. It's kind of a experimental ethnography where the author, who was African-American, who had studied under Margaret Mead, interestingly, does a series of interviews with African-Americans, and he largely just presents the interviews. I mean, he categorizes them, gives short little introductions to them, but it's a sort of presentation of African-American voices. And in the first section, the critiques of kind of America and the flag and just being Black in the United States are really powerful, and they're so contemporary. Right, thinking about what's going on today. So that's another figure that I don't talk about in the book. It sort of comes after the period where the book ends, that I'd point folks towards as well as, you know, there's so much important contemporary work from Black anthropologists that I couldn't even begin to enumerate.
And so what's next for you? Like, now that you've finished this project, do you have another one on the burner?
Nothing on a burner. Burner's off. No, what's one of the things I realized in writing this book when it was too late was that somebody really needs to write the history of what the hell happened in anthropology in the late 60s and early 70s. And it's probably not the work any one person can take on. But you know, I would have loved to have that book, right, when writing this one. And I don't pretend my chapter 6 does that job. It begins to get at some slices of the importance of that moment. But I don't think that's something I'm going to take on myself. We'll see. But at this point, I sort of felt like I had a story to tell about this subject between the 20s and early 70s, and I'll, you know, leave it alone. What I'm actually thinking about is doing some kind of ethnography around private property, which is a kind of another shift that's I can make connections between both this project and my earlier project where, you know, for Garifuna, land rights struggles, you know, have been one of, if not the key political issue, you know, since I started work there in the early 90s. Questions of collective rights versus individual rights when it comes to property, and even the whole framework of property is kind of under critique from indigenous ontological perspectives. All those kinds of things resonate with my earlier work. But my interest really came out of, as you know, in Santa Cruz, there was a big struggle over rent control that my sense of time now, I think was just last year, right? Or maybe it was 2 years ago when there were efforts to get rent control passed in the city of Santa Cruz that ultimately failed. And just talking to people in town about rent made me really interested in, or rent control made me really interested in the kinds of attachments people have to certain ideals of private property. So any discussion, any analysis of property has to also, you know, is indelibly tied up with questions of race. And so I'm not sure where I'm going to go with this, but I'm kind of thinking of doing a different kind of ethnographic project, and it could even bring me back to Honduras. But I'm just really not sure at this point.
No, this sounds like a great project. As a person who lived in Santa Cruz for 3 years, I'll say that if you can do something about that rental market, we'll all love you forever. Well, until then, I just want to thank you for coming on the show. I really enjoyed reading your book, and it was great to be able to chat with you about it.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity. It was fun.